The Indian subcontinent is renowned for its railways, and I know many, many Australians are big users of them. It's the world's third largest network. On any given day, it carries more than 20 million people between 6,800 stations. It was developed under the rule of the British Raj and Governor-General Lord Dalhousie, primarily in the mid to late 19th century. He was called the maker of modern India, and he felt strongly that a network of railways connecting the main cities with the ports was needed for both strategic and commercial needs. And in echoes of huge debates within our own wide brown land about rail gauges, he wanted one broad gauge, but he lost that argument. In the end, four were constructed. And it's to the narrow gauge railways that we now turn our attention via a beautiful new book brought to our attention by a listener called Peter. It's published by Goodman Feel, by the late Australian photojournalist Angus MacDonald. It's called India's Disappearing Railways, where Angus travels on 10 narrow gauge lines, taking sometimes funny, sometimes confronting, but I assure you, stunning photos along the way. Sadly, Angus died just before the book could be completed, and his fiancée, Catherine Anderson, who accompanied him on some of his journeys, ended up editing the book. She joins us now from the studios of BBC Cumbria. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
This beautiful book, Catherine, is more or less the story, in pictures and a few words, of 10 narrow-gauge railway lines in India. Why did he choose them?
Well, I think rather they chose him. He loved trains, like most little boys. I think he'd grown up, you know, fascinated by anything, you know, on wheels or on tracks that moved. But India, of course, is particularly, you know, famous for its immense network, as you mentioned, and particularly the hill trains and the narrow gauge hill trains, one of which, the Kangra Valley Railway, which travelled where Angus based himself, which was in the foothills of the Western Himalayas in North India, in a place called McLeod Ganj. So that was the one he first fell in love with. And then sort of it became a mission for him to visit all of the narrow gauges, or as many of them as he could find in India.
And were these lines constructed in the first place by the British for the British, or is it a little bit more complicated?
Oh, yes, much more complicated. The great misconception is that they were the toy trains, you know, the archetypal Darjeeling and Kalka Shimla railways were little playthings of the Raj. And, well, those two were, in fact, but they were not the first narrow gauges to be built in India. And the first narrow gauge ever to be built in India was built by a local Maharaja in the Dubai network in Gujarat, which was actually built to transport cotton during the global cotton shortage that had been caused by the American Civil War. So curiously, the majority actually of the lines in this book were built and conceived by Indians themselves. So you're right, it was a lot more complicated than just the British administration essentially strengthening their network, you know, allowing themselves to get from the plains to the hills during the summer months. It was a lot more complicated than that.
Yes, and the pictures of the people are just simply wonderful. Yeah. They and the joy, because all too often I feel India is shown in all its colour, but its misery, if you know what I mean. And there's certainly some of that here, but it's to me, the exuberance of the trains that comes through.
Yeah. Well, no, that's a great word to describe it. I mean, anyone who thinks the book is about, you know, the mechanics of the trains will probably be a little bit disappointed, because they are mostly about the people. And these lines are about the people that use them. And the joy that it exudes from every shot, really, is tangible. And I don't know if you've travelled yourself by rail in India, but it is a glorious, you know, all-consuming experience. It's of all the senses, you know, and I think that comes across in the pictures, definitely.
What is the state of these narrow gauge lines?
Well, the book is called India's Disappearing Railways, and the disappearing does refer to the fact that they are a dying breed, if you like. They are almost an extinct species. The Governor Dalhousie's dream of a single gauge has been readopted by modern Indian governments, who, of course, you know, see a single gauge as being the model of efficiency. And of course, it would be more efficient to have a single gauge in India. But, many of these lines, they adapted to the landscape. They had to be narrow gauge lines. So whole communities have grown to depend on these lines. And sadly, though, they are increasingly in a state of disrepair and neglect. And some of the lines that Angus photographed just, 5 years ago are now reduced from a couple of hundred kilometres to 40, 50 kilometres in length. So there is an argument for preserving them as you would a historic monument or something of equal sociocultural value.
Well, that's what Sir Mark Tully, who does the foreword, he says, in a way, is Angus's epitaph, that he's given these such loving attention. He's hoping that's exactly what will occur to them, that they become preserved. But I did wonder, does that mean that they're going to have an enormous appeal for tourists, like the Darjeeling Himalayan Railway, do they still have a functional purpose for the local people?
Well, quite. India's modernising at a vast rate, but the effects of that modernisation are felt by, less than 20% of the population, and the majority still do rely on trains and buses, of course, in India. But where there's a train, they can scale greater heights quicker. It's a worry. And obviously, the UNESCO listed lines such as the Darjeeling, which you mentioned, they attract tourism and they are in and of themselves a great sort of drawer of income to the local economies. But in doing so, you do, of course, alienate the communities that have used them for hundreds of years already.
What, you displace them? They can't use it if
you're
using it.
Well, potentially, yes. I mean, the Darjeeling line is known as the school train, for example, because it carries all the hill children up to their schools in Darjeeling and back again. But there's a chance that it becomes so, stuffed full of tourists that it ceases to have that function, which would be a great shame. Mm. Do many Australians visit?
Go on these lines, do you know?
Oh, yes, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know the precise numbers, but the Kalka-Shimla and the Darjeeling lines are always, I'd say sort of 70% tourists and 30% right. locals. But of course, many of the tourists now are wealthy, well-to-do Indians for whom tourism in their own country is a growing thing.
I've just got to read you, before we go into details about Angus, gorgeous writing about the Gwalior light rail. All the elements, I'll just have a little snatch of it, all the elements of bucolic classicism are there. As the train has barely left Gwalior before it plunges into an undulating desert of twisted acacia populated by deer, nilgai and peacocks. All the elements of bucolic classicism are there. The wicker gate, the buffalo lined up companionably in their stalls, the hand pump, the threshing yard, pats of cow dung bearing handprints are piled into worshipful mounds shaped like hayricks or temples. Now, did you see it quite as sentimentally as that? Because I can find India, I have to tell you, rather challenging.
Well, I confess I'm an Indiaphile. I love it. Insofar as you can fall in madly in love with a place, India's it for me. So, yes, I mean, in India you see beauty in everything, but you can also see a lot of suffering. That's the country, and that's obviously something that some people might focus more on. I don't see the beauty to the abandonment of all else, but it's a country that I fell very deeply in love with and am very fond of. So, and of course, Angus writes beautifully, so he's able to paint that picture for someone who's never been for someone, yes.
So, what was his favourite line?
Well, to go back to the Kangra Valley Railway, that was the line that he said, quote, the most beautiful railway line in the world, which I'm sure others might disagree with, but it was particularly stunning. I mean, the place where Angus and I met in India was McLeod Ganj in that area of the Himalayas. And it is particularly beautiful because you can be on the plains of the tea-growing district of the Kangra Valley and within minutes you're climbing up to elevations of a few hundred metres into those foothills and you're in the craggy, snowy, the iconic Himalayan look of those peaks.
Mm. And, now, you had to edit the book, Catherine, after Angus died, which is pretty sad. Was that a difficult task or one with unusual meaning for you?
Well, it was a great joy, really. I hadn't had the good fortune to travel with him on all of these lines, but I felt by the end of the editing process that I had, in a sense, been there with him. It was he'd done a lot of preparation for it himself, but it was a lovely experience, and obviously I undertook it in the year after he died. So when you're going through that process, you're constantly trying to find ways to find that person again in your daily life, and there he was right there, you know, every day I was working on the book. So it was, of course, a time of awful sadness, but it was also a lovely experience.
Do you mind me asking, was his death unexpected?
Well, it was when it actually happened. It was very abrupt and sudden. He actually died when we were travelling in Burma. It was a brief remission. He'd had a fairly sort of unconventional radiation treatment, which had, in fact, caused his tumour markers to drop right down. He'd been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer about 10 months prior to that. So, he was absolutely desperate to travel, to get back to Asia, and decided to travel to a country that he'd been to before and which he did love, which was Burma. We went there for the first Irrawaddy Literary Festival, which was a great event in and of itself. You know, it was symbolic of all the very sudden positive changes that had happened in Burma prior to 2013, so 2011 to 2012, and San Suu Kyi was there, and it was wonderful. So we had a superb time in Burma, travelling around, and unfortunately, though, I think I can't be certain, but you know, the chances are that he
picked up.
He
something.
Was probably too weak, possibly had picked up an infection, possibly suffered some sort of an embolism, but he actually died at the airport as we were leaving to go back to Sydney. Yeah.
Look, tell us about the exhibition that accompanies the book and what role you play in that, because that could draw listeners in too.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited because we did, when the book was published in Britain last November, we secured an exhibition at the Royal Geographical Society in London. And it was beautifully done, curated by a graduate of Goldsmiths College. It was a free exhibition. We had about 40 of Angus's shots framed for sale, and it was open throughout December and early January in London. So that was marvellous. The book, of course, is now distributed in Australia and published there. And I was keen to do the same thing, and we'll be having an exhibition at the Customs House in Sydney. And then we will be moving it to the 45 Downstairs Gallery in Melbourne in early December.
Oh, terrific. Oh, well, look, yes. That's very good. I'm sure that that's exactly what Radio National listeners would like to come and see. So, Catherine Anderson, I'm happy for you. Thank you very much indeed for joining
us. Thank you, Geraldine.
It's a wonderful work.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
And my thanks to Catherine Anderson, who was the editor of India's Disappearing Railways, A Photographic Journey by Angus MacDonald. It's been published by Goodman Fiel, that's F-I-E-L-L. And those exhibitions have been and gone by and large, but I invite you to go to our website where you can see some of the beautiful photos from Angus.